Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Much has been written about the interaction of the pursuit of peace and the pursuit of justice on the international scene, and much of it, I think, is fair to say, champions accountability and assumes that justice is or should be an instrument of peace. If there is a debate in the literature, it's now cast as a debate between, at the extremes, the so-called justice fundamentalists, who are said to make all sorts of unsubstantiated assumptions about the deterrent effect of prosecutions and the contribution that justice makes to national reconciliation on one side. And then at the other extreme, those who are caricatured as real politic apparatchiks who work only for the deal and belittle the pursuit of anything good or moral. In reality, frankly, I think there is a consensus in the moderate discourse that both peace and justice are highly desirable. On a case-by-case basis, however, there's considerably less consensus about how to accommodate both, and there's no general framework for resolving the tensions, if any, between the two. So what I would like to do with you is to explore two different models of the interlinkage between the pursuit of peace and the pursuit of justice. One I will call the sequencing model, and the second one I'll call the parallel tracks model. Now let me turn first to the sequencing model. This could also be called the justice as a tool of peace model. In a nutshell, this model accepts the desirability of both peace and justice in principle, but it sees the two as separate. It assumes that there's a link between the two, and that this link is through a political process. It proposes a range of choices in timing, peace first, or in processes, including amnesties, truth and reconciliation commissions, and so on, reflecting the possibility of justice having to yield to superior peace objectives. I think it's fair to say that this is the model on which we're currently operating, although, of course, it's not articulated as such. Implicitly, the current model, in my view, favors peace over justice. Put another way, it would never accept that war be the price of justice, but it concedes that injustice, or lack of justice, for those who think that there's a difference between the two, may have to be the price of peace. This model positions itself very much at the outset of peace and justice initiatives. Typically, it outlines possible strategies for peace negotiators who will wish to have a panoply of options to induce the parties to come to a peace agreement. So from that point of view, the threat of criminal sanction is a useful tool as long as that threat can also be suspended or withdrawn altogether. Justice is thus viewed as a tool of peace, not in the sense that there can be no real peace without justice, but in the sense that in some cases, prosecuting war criminals may be conducive to peace, and in other cases, not. This model obviously assumes that the untimely pursuit of justice can be an impediment to peace. War criminals would be unlikely to sign peace agreements that would include their own prosecutions. The prosecution process could inflame public opinion in support of war criminals and therefore lead to retaliation, say, against peacekeepers. The cost of prosecution could divert resources from other initiatives essential to the peace-building process and so on. So under this model, even though in principle both peace and justice are accepted as desirable social goals, justice can be made subservient to peace, but not vice versa. As justice is desirable only if it fosters peace, the determination of which, under this model, is case-specific. The sequencing model, therefore, puts justice in the toolbox of peace negotiators. At the time that peace talks are underway, the criminal process is sometimes a distant option, or may be already far advanced. When the prospect of criminal accountability is remote, the task of the peace negotiators is obviously easier, without the criminal process losing all its relevance. But at the other extreme, when the international criminal process is far advanced, the clash between the interest of peace and the interest of justice become more acute. The actual indictment of political or military leaders such as Charles Taylor in Liberia, President Bashir of Sudan, or Joseph Kony of the Lord Resistance Army, even if they're welcome on moral or even on legal grounds, these initiatives are rarely applauded by potential peacemakers as useful in the pursuit of their objectives. Unless, of course, they can control the fate of the indictment. The provision in the statute of the International Criminal Court, which creates a link between the Security Council and the court, reflects perfectly this model. It permits the Security Council to refer a case to the ICC, which was actually the case in the Darfur case, which one has to assume is premised on the assumption that justice will be instrumental to peace, and it also permits the Security Council to request a deferral of ongoing investigations or prosecutions, presumably on the converse assumption that the unfolding of justice process is adverse to peace interests. I think it may be useful to unpack the first assumption. What does it mean when the Security Council initiates, quote, a justice process, as it did in creating the tribunals for Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, and as it did in referring the Darfur case to the ICC? International criminal justice addresses war crimes, not war itself. The threat of prosecution may deter further perpetration of war crimes, but not the continued pursuit of war. The distinction is easily blurred when, as in my view in the case of Darfur, the military operations are so disproportionately targeted at civilians that there are, in a sense, more war crimes than there is war itself, that is, traditional engagements between combatants. But the distinction is otherwise useful. Waging war is not a crime. When a peace process is initiated and the cessation of war is at stake, the commission of war crimes is subsumed under the larger objective. If war ends, so will war crimes. So the efficacy of the threat of prosecution to prevent war crimes ceases to have much relevance and, in fact, becomes a real nuisance when it appears to stand in the way of the cessation of war altogether. Accordingly, the criminal justice process for war crimes will very rarely be a priority for peace negotiators. At most, they may agree to explicitly provide that no amnesties for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide can be provided in a deal that is sponsored by the international community. If the justice process has already been launched, as in the case of the Lord Resistance Army in Uganda, peace negotiators typically search for a wide range of options to trade it away. Interestingly, in the case of the LRA negotiations, no one advocated, at least publicly, that there should be no accountability whatsoever, nor that this, not that this would necessarily be an unpopular opinion, even in northern Uganda itself. But the legal reality is that Joseph Kony and others are already indicted by the ICC, and as a result of that, there are fewer tools in the peace toolbox. The only option, and even this one is not fully in political hands, is the choice of national prosecutions rather than one by the ICC under the principle of complementarity. But I have no doubt that if the existence of the ICC indictment had not already narrowed down the political options, the preferred course for some would be, if not amnesty for war crimes, which the UN could not support, then at least silence and inaction on the justice agenda in favor of a political settlement for the cessation of LRA activities. In short, the sequencing model is a more political than juridical model. It prefers peace to justice, although it purports to like both. So let me turn briefly to what I will call the parallel tracks model. In a nutshell, this model asserts that peace and justice are inseparable. It rejects that there's a link between the two that should be managed through a political process. It proposes to remove justice as a tool in the hands of peace negotiators, and it insists that justice should follow its own course. Now, this model assumes not that justice should be an ingredient of peace, but that it is. In that sense, the two are totally inseparable. At common law, a crime is a breach of the peace. A police officer is called a peace officer. We have justices of the peace and peace bonds, which are promises to keep the peace, in part by not committing crimes. At the same time, we all understand that the unfolding of a criminal process is not always peaceful. It can actually be violent. Lawful arrest may include the use of whatever reasonable force is necessary in the circumstances, including lethal force. The trial itself is at times very disturbing for victims, for witnesses, for family members who have to relive very traumatic experiences, when in fact they may very well have chosen to be left alone, in peace. So when justice is viewed as integral to peace, it actually understands that peace is not just the absence of raging conflict. Peace is also a sense of security restored, which subsumes the need for revenge by the appropriation of the harm by the community at large and in the solidarity expressed with the victim. It is also a reaffirmation of a commitment to the peaceful resolution of conflicts and to results that are accepted even by the so-called losers because they rest on largely acceptable processes. Without doubt, this model rejects that the link between peace and justice, a very intimate link woven in the fabric of society itself, should be handled by political actors or put at the service of political interest. In fact, the opposite is true. The justice agenda is insulated from political interference, even in parliamentary democracies where the chief law enforcement officer, the Attorney General, is in fact an elected member of parliament and a member of cabinet. In such cases, sophisticated measures are put in place to ensure the independence of the justice track over the political one. Not because politics are bad and judicial processes are good, but because of the fundamental requirements of the rule of law, including the constitutional imperatives of separation of power and the ideals of equality under and before the law. In fact, one of the greatest challenges for the implementation of international criminal justice is precisely the absence of a similar international governance structure in which courts occupy their proper place alongside a real executive and legislative branch. And yet, adapted to its international context, justice can and should still strive to maintain the sine qua non of its integrity while adapting to the governance structure in which it's required to fit. The parallel track model, therefore, proposes to remove justice as a tool in the hands of peacemakers and insists that justice should just follow its own course. Under this model, the decisions to issue, to stay, or to withdraw an indictment are not matters over which politicians and diplomats are expected to exert any influence. These decisions are simply part of the reality within which the negotiations have to be conducted, including the suitability of indicted war criminals formally acting as peace negotiators. One might argue that the parallel track model simply and inappropriately shifts the political implication of justice from politicians where it belongs to prosecutors where it doesn't. Now, there's no doubt that prosecutorial discretion occupies center stage under this model, and that its exercise involves considerations that could be said to be of a political nature. But in my view, these considerations are different from the political factors that would require a trade-off between the dual objectives of peace and justice. The prosecutor is always required to exercise his or her discretion in the interest of justice. The timing of an indictment can be validly determined by the likelihood of leading to a successful arrest, which in turn can be determined by assessing the political will to perform the arrest as and when the indictment is issued. Whether the existence of the indictment should be made public or kept confidential also involves weighing the interest of justice, which include a vast array of considerations ultimately related to the effectiveness, the credibility, and the general public acceptance of the prosecutorial process. Under this model, prosecutorial discretion is very large, and it encompasses the selection of prosecution targets amongst the many who could be convicted if charged, but who cannot be charged for a lack of resources or for a lot of other valid reasons. In that environment, the room for improper political consideration is clearly there, and the assumption that politics will play a part is difficult to rebut. This, therefore, requires a sophisticated determination of the scope of the powers of the prosecutor and a consideration of the need for oversight on the exercise of these powers. This requires a detailed analysis of the desirable contours of the discretion of the prosecutor and of his or her independence vis-à-vis many actors, including the judges of the ICC and the registrar, the Assembly of State Parties, the Security Council, and the representatives of the Secretary General and other peace envoys, as well as individual member states. This could include the articulation of public guidelines in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. As a starter, I would suggest that they should be a virtual firewall between the prosecutor, indeed between the International Criminal Court itself, and the Security Council. Now, much could be said about the independence of the prosecutor, and quite a bit has been written already about the exercise of his or her discretion and the checks and balances necessary to enhance confidence in the professionalism, the integrity, and the sound judgment of a prosecutor. The question here is not to debate whether the prosecutor has or doesn't have a political role. In fact, it's often pointed out that an international prosecutor operates in an intensely political environment. Surprisingly to me, it's not often pointed out that the international prosecutor operates in an intensely criminal environment. When investigations are launched into massive killings, torture, rape, and persecutions of all sorts, it may be a little more difficult to obscure that criminal reality. But even then, and worse when prosecutions are for what are seen as technical offenses, say war crimes, rather than crimes against humanity, it's easier to revert to the perception of the issues as being first and foremost political rather than justiciable. And this should come as no surprise considering how recently we've initiated this recourse to personal criminal responsibility for international crimes. At the time of the creation of the International Criminal Court, there was a climate of suspicion towards the risk of a so-called rogue prosecutor perverting the entire process. Although the ICC statute ultimately provides for the power of the prosecutor to institute proceedings on his or her own initiative, there has been considerable resistance to that power, and in reality, all the prosecutions initiated so far by the ICC prosecutor have been either at the request of a state or by referral to the Security Council. This is consistent, in my view, with the fact that we have collectively bought in to the sequencing model, in large part because of the history of the first ad hoc tribunals and by the statute of the ICC, all that having assumed a political role in the administration of criminal justice, which I think for the time being is irreversible. If the Security Council continues to launch ad hoc initiatives, as in the case of the Tribunal for Lebanon, for instance, and as long as it has the capacity to refer cases to the ICC, it will be very difficult to develop a framework that insulates international criminal justice from political considerations. Under the parallel track model, there's no doubt that the two highly desirable features for an international criminal court would be, first, universality in the jurisdiction of the court, and second, prosecutorial discretion properly circumscribed by law as the sole method of initiating prosecutions. If in principle the parallel track model is the preferable one in the longer term, one could advocate measures that would blur some of the distinctions between the two models and minimize the adverse effects of the possibilities for political overlap under the circumstances as they currently exist. The problem with the role of political actors in the unfolding of international criminal prosecutions, in my view, is that it makes it clear that if the judicial process can be interrupted for political reasons, then it follows that it can also be activated for political reasons. And this, in my view, taints the justice enterprise at its core. And frankly, to speak the language of the so-called realist, I think that to introduce criminal accountability options in peace talks complicates rather than facilitates the work of peace negotiators. This is so because it purports to put on the table elements that in fact cannot be negotiated solely by the parties or as the parties may wish, particularly when institutional initiatives such as an indictment by the ICC have already been launched. Worse still, putting criminal justice options on the table could put the negotiators in the position of having to condone unjust, if not unconscionable, deals. For example, under the existing situation, when an indictment has already been issued at the time that peace negotiations are launched, negotiators would be very well advised to state clearly at the outset the limit of what is feasible in withdrawing charges. Even when a possible deferral by the Security Council could be on the table, it should be stated very clearly for what it is. It's a mere temporary suspension of the proceedings for up to 12 months renewable, and not a perpetual shield against prosecution. And as for the party's potential preference for national prosecutions, as seemed to have been the case in the Uganda LRA negotiations, it should also be made explicit that that decision on that issue is solely the role of the ICC judges. It's beyond the scope of my talk today to analyze in detail the role of the Security Councils in referral and deferral requests to the International Criminal Court. As I indicated, under a better system, in my view, the Security Council would have no such role. Referrals are, of course, useful since they allow the ICC to be seized of cases that would otherwise not be within its jurisdiction. But since, of course, there's no real possibility of the referral of a case against one of the permanent five members of the Security Council's council or their protégés because of their veto rights, there's already a serious affront to the interest of justice that is built in to the referral concept. As for deferrals, in my opinion, it's very difficult to imagine a circumstance where it would be appropriate for the Security Council to request the deferral of a mere investigation. The imperatives of procuring and securing the evidence in a timely manner should always trump the fear that the continuation of the investigation could legitimately impede the pursuit of peace. If anything, this proceeds on a presumption of guilt that those seeking the deferral should want to avoid. As for deferring a prosecution, the statute prescribes no conditions and gives no criteria for the exercise of this prerogative. On the one hand, we could assume that being a prerogative of a political body, it should rest on political considerations. On the other hand, one could argue that as a step in the unfolding of a judicial process, it should be exercised by the Security Council in a quasi-judicial manner. That is, it should be exercised for principled, expressed reasons that are consistent with the objectives of the statute of the ICC and not designed to sabotage them. In that way, for instance, a deferral could be requested for reasons similar to the reasons that could trigger a referral by the Security Council to the ICC. that the parallel tracks of peace and justice have experienced a temporary overlap. The power of deferral is not a power of amnesty. I would suggest that only when a real peace process is underway and when a delay in the prosecutorial process would be necessary to facilitate the completion of a peace agreement should a deferral by the Security Council be even considered. And frankly, I think there would be very few such circumstances. Those allegedly seeking delay are most likely really seeking a withdrawal, or better still, a total dismissal of the charges against them. And this is not open to the Security Council to grant, nor, frankly, is it open to the prosecutor at his or her sole initiative. Once charges are laid, the matter is in the hands of the court, which cannot and should not be brought in directly or indirectly into the political discussions regarding the resolutions of a conflict. Although we have not been engaged in that complex exercise for very long, it is, in my view, irreversible. But it has a long way to go before international criminal law finds its proper place alongside conflict resolution efforts and alongside the many other initiatives related to social justice that are necessary for the foundation of a better, more peaceful, more just, more equitable world. The worst we could do is to expect more of international criminal law enforcement than we do in a domestic environment. Or actually, maybe the worst we could do is to expect less, to expect that it has to be politicized, that it cannot be as good, that it has to compromise. But we need also to understand the truly unique indigenous environment in which international criminal law operates, and we must design norms, standards, principles, and rules that are suited to that environment and not that simply mimic even the best of what we have refined in a particular national criminal justice system. In conclusion, if the short history of international criminal justice is any indication, the indictment against President al-Bashir of Sudan will not go away. In all likelihood, he will eventually stand trial before the judges of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The possibility of a credible domestic prosecution in the Sudan being remote in the extreme. Political efforts will be deployed to prevent the judicial process from taking its course, largely because the process tolerates these efforts. In the longer term, as the system matures and consolidates its credibility, I believe that the judicial track will stand more and more on its own. I assume that the government of Sudan prefers the political realm over the judicial one and prefers, above all, the primacy of the political over the juridical. I wonder what the victims in Darfur would prefer and who will speak for them at peace talks or in the Security Council. Thank you very much for your attention.
Could you clarify, in comparison to the other gross violations, what are crimes against humanity in international criminal law, and have there been any cases targeting specifically certain kinds of crimes against humanity?
Yeah, well, crimes against humanity have their origin in the Nuremberg Charter and the Nuremberg trials, and they basically look at very severe offenses against the person. So, murder, rape, torture, deportation, persecutions of all sorts, but that are committed either on a systematic or large, as a large-scale enterprise. So a handful of assassinations may not qualify as a crime against humanity, but large-scale or systematic attacks on civilian populations would. And then we have war crimes that often overlap with crimes against humanity. We haven't been in this business long enough to have a rich, broad jurisprudential base upon which we could draw examples and draw the contours of, you know, what is large scale enough, what is widespread enough. And I can assure you that in ICTY and ICTR, when we sat together experienced domestic prosecutors, because they were no pre-existing international criminal prosecutors, we had to exercise some judgment as to what the court would be likely to find to be sufficiently widespread or systematic enterprises to elevate a conduct from, in some cases, I hate to say a mere war crimes, they're not mere, but a war crime, to the scale of a crime against humanity. I should also add that there is, I think, a misconception in the public that genocide is altogether of another order of magnitude. And I think it's very difficult to, and dangerous maybe, to make that kind of distinction, that if a large-scale slaughter of civilian is not conducted with the genocidal intent, which is an intent essentially to exterminate a group of people on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religion, and so on, that if it hasn't been elevated by that perverse intent, it's not very serious. Well, crimes against humanity are very serious offenses, and the distinction between, and the courts have already found in some cases, that they could not be totally satisfied that the intent fit the definition of genocidal intent in the Genocide Convention, but otherwise clearly constituted the massive killing, rape, torture, persecution, and so on, that amounts to a crime against humanity. So I think it's important not to, in a sense, almost romanticize or exaggerate the evil content of genocide, not because it doesn't deserve to be denounced as maybe the ultimate crime, but because it may serve to unduly diminish the atrocious significance of these other international crimes that in some cases are barely distinguishable from acts of genocide.
I imagine I speak for many of the people in this audience in agreeing with you that it's high time that al-Bashir was brought to trial for his crimes against people of Darfur. But this has led not only to political pushback against this among African countries, but the expulsion of humanitarian organizations and probably increased violence against the people of Darfur. I wonder if you could comment in somewhat more detail on this in light of the criteria you set forth for the adequate exercise of the parallel track model, the timing of the prosecution, going public with it, the likelihood of actually getting an arrest and so forth. Do you think this is an effective use of the parallel track?
Well, first, let me say that we should be, there's a few preliminary remarks about the reaction of President al-Bashir to the indictment. First, I think the first thing we need to constantly point out is that in his apparent desire to retaliate against the international community, he actually retaliated against the most vulnerable of his own people, of the people under which he has at law a duty, a responsibility to protect. This, I think, in and of itself complements largely the allegations that are made against him in the indictment, and I think we should be very explicit about that. The second thing is, when we look at the expulsion of the international NGOs from Darfur as the, I'll put it, the price of the indictment, I think we should always be conscious that we never measure the price of inaction. A lot happened while we were not indicting him in the 3 or 4 years in which this indictment had not been forthcoming, and I'm not blaming anybody for that, but we weren't counting every day the cost of not calling him to account. So we tend again to exaggerate the consequences of action because we never measure the cost of inaction. Now, when I say it's not political considerations that should determine whether the criminal process should be activated, in the case of Darfur, the criminal process was activated by a political decision. It's the Security Council that referred the Darfur case to the ICC. Why? Because at that time, it was very politically convenient when there was so much paralysis in the Security Council about other, maybe more robust measures, like some form of military action, or even declaring a no-fly zone and so on. This seemed like a pretty innocuous initiative. Looks good, everybody likes it, it looks like you're doing something. But it seems to me that after you've made the decision to activate the criminal justice system, you can't reserve the right to interfere for political reasons about the timing and the methodology and should it be charged with genocide or not. That was for the court to determine. The prosecutor alleged genocide. The court was split 2-3 as to whether on the evidence as it existed at the time of the indictment, there was enough for it. It would have been unthinkable that this fine decision be made in the Security Council. The timing of the indictment is the same thing. When I was the prosecutor, I initiated this strategy of secret indictments. I think it was my call, and many objected, I think in part because it proved successful, and so they objected because they really didn't want it to work. When I arrived there, the Tribunal for Yugoslavia had already indicted about 75 people. Their names and faces, when we had photographs, were in posters all over Bosnia. The first time I went to the region, at every NATO checkpoint, there was a big poster with all the names and pictures of the indictees. Well, what a surprise. There was never an encounter between NATO troops and indicted war criminals. Well, it seemed to me it's pretty obvious why this was the case, and NATO's mandate was not to pursue them, merely to arrest them if they encountered them in the course of their operations. Well, they would not have encountered them until hell froze over with their pictures there. So we persuaded the courts, essentially even more in a more sinister strategy, we identified people against whom we already were pretty advanced in our investigations as people with whom the NATO leadership had regular meetings once every 2 weeks or once a month, a local chief of police or a political leader. So we rushed to complete our investigations, got the court to issue an indictment, and then asked the court not to make that public. So then we could go to NATO and said, when you meet police officer so-and-so or general so-and-so or president so-and-so next week at your meeting, guess what? You'll be having an encounter because here's the arrest warrant. Now, that was effective. To me, that kind of strategy has to be in the hands of the prosecutor. Now, in doing so, we were very alive to the fact that they could be political consequences or humanitarian consequences. We weren't equipped to assess that with great sophistication or, frankly, to do much about it. And I think under the ICC statute, the prosecutor is entitled, in fact required, to act at all times in the interest of justice. And I think the interest of justice include not deliberately or recklessly doing considerably more harm than good in the unfolding of the process. Again, analogies with domestic situations are not always very good, but domestically, when the police decide to conduct a very large-scale operation, they strategize about how to maximize the chances of successful arrest with minimum casualties, particularly innocent people being caught in the unfolding of the process. But we would never contemplate that we should not move forward on law enforcement initiatives because they are, as they unfold, they're not always that peaceful. And certainly, we wouldn't want the call to be made by politicians for purely political reasons as to how, when, and under what circumstances law enforcement operations should unfold. We're a long way from that, and I concede that's considerably more complex in the international scene, but I think we should just equip the prosecutor with enough capacity to be a responsible international actor in these circumstances, and as I said before, make sure that he or she operates under some pre-established oversight mechanism for fear, again, of either reckless or worse initiatives. But I still believe that despite what we've seen as the immediate, very defiant reaction in Darfur, the worst we could do is to cow away and concede that this was all very misguided because it has added to the suffering of a population that in any event was doomed to continue to suffer tremendously regardless of this indictment.
Going back to the 1980s, Reagan was waging an illegal war against the people of Central America. And the Nicaraguan government brought a case to the ICC, and they had, I believe, 20 counts, and the ICC found Reagan guilty of 19 out of the 20 counts, including waging a war of aggression. One thing that can happen is you can have a domestic attempt to find justice, and there was actually a case brought to the Supreme Court of the United States, and Supreme Court ruled in the United States, no, we consider such cases to be political. We don't deal with cases of foreign policy. So the elephant in the living room is, what does it mean to have international law if you have this bully that basically can go around and wage wars of aggression? And obviously the current elephant in the living room is the immediate previous administration in the case of Iraq.
All right. Just a few clarification. The Nicaragua case was not a case before the ICC. It was a case before the ICJ, the International Court of Justice.
Sorry.
Well, it's a very important point.
Okay.
The International Criminal Court did not exist at that time. There was no international framework for personal criminal accountability. The International Court of Justice resolves disputes between states, but doesn't point fingers as the International Criminal Court does, putting military and political leaders that fall within its jurisdiction, and unfortunately that jurisdiction now is still far from universal. This country has not ratified the statute of the International Criminal Court. But for those who fall within its jurisdiction, it has now sent a signal that not only may your country have to pay damages to an aggrieved other country, but you actually personally may end up in jail if, in the conduct of warfare, you have committed these crimes. Okay, second point, waging war or the so-called crime of aggression does not currently exist in international criminal law. So waging or unlawfully, aggressively starting a war is not, in and of itself, not a war crime, it's not a crime against humanity, it's not an act of genocide. So as the framework of personal criminal liability exists internationally, we're not even there yet. This was the quid pro quo. There were several things left out.
There were 19 counts that they found the U.S. guilty.
Well, yeah, the U.S.
Yeah, no, I understand. And the U.S. removed itself from jurisdiction. The U.S. was levied penalties in that case, and the U.S. just said, no, we're not going to pay.
Right. Well, you know.
Because the other crimes were torture and other crimes against humanity.
Well, that's where I think we have progressed tremendously since then, with, I think, the possibility of some being held personally accountable. Now, whether that includes those who still have the political and the de facto power to escape accountability, that is American exceptionalism, that's still their reality, that the chances, which is often used as an argument, which I find totally incomprehensible, the chances under the current system that an American could be brought to justice before the International Criminal Court against the will of the American government are small in the extreme. I mean, not even imaginable, never mind a leader or... So that is the reality.
What does it mean to have a system of international justice? Why, if I were Bashir, why would I feel like I'm subject to this?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it to you, echoing exactly your concerns. When I was the prosecutor for ICTY, every time I went to Belgrade, I was told by all my interlocutors in the government, in the media, frankly, even in not NGO communities, but social, civil society generally, the question that was put to me every time was, why us? What got into you to pick on us? Where were you when Idi Amin was killing and raping his own people, and Duvalier in Haiti, and the killing fields in Cambodia? Where were you all that time? Why did you wake up one day and decided to pick on us? To me, there's only one answer to this question, which is as follows. The fact that others, equally guilty, are not brought to account doesn't make you less guilty. But I have to concede that it makes it less just to single you out. And when you're in the justice business, being less than just is not a good position to be in. What do we do about it? Not, I'll leave you alone. We have to work towards universality. That's what the rule of law requires. No one is above the law. Do we have that kind of rule of law internationally today? I don't think so. Does that mean that we shouldn't charge Bashir because we're not there yet? We're not quite as just as ultimately we will need to be? I don't think so. I think we have to pursue this incremental, you know, there's over, what is it today, 110 countries that have ratified the statute of the ICC. It's not nothing. Now, of course, until the larger, more important countries join the rank, it will always look like a pretty severe deficit. But it doesn't mean we should wait until everybody's ready to go, in which case, I think we're going to create a momentum. You know, criminal law, people think it's about coercion. Criminal law is about compliance. That's the way it works. People buy in to the idea that that's how we're going to resolve our disputes. This is how we're going to come together as a community, reaffirm our values, re-express ourselves. It's hard enough to do domestically. It's very hard to do internationally. And I think the momentum is there. And even though we have to be very sober about the process and how far and not quite far enough we've gone to this point, I don't think it's a reason to cynically walk away from it. And I'll say one last thing, which is that even under the statute of the International Criminal Court, there is a clear preference for domestic prosecutions. And the ICC is required to defer not even to domestic prosecutions, but merely to bona fide domestic investigations. So if any country can show, a country that would otherwise fall under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, can show that it has made good faith efforts to investigate and has come to the conclusion that further prosecutions are not warranted, that defeats the jurisdiction of the ICC. So there's a clear preference for the work being done where criminal law normally is done, which is, you know, that's the root of the jury trial. Huh? It's in the smallest unit that has been victimized, the immediate community. So the advocacy that we must make, first and above all, is for domestic accountability.
How would you respond to a country we know of that would support today the establishment of an international criminal court and yet systematically exclude itself from its jurisdiction? What is the response?
Well, it's a pretty untenable position that undermines the advocacy effort of that hypothetical country, which I cannot even begin to imagine who it is we could be thinking about. But again, if one believes, as I do, that, say, the United States has an international human rights agenda that it wishes to promote for the betterment of many around the world, it has to understand how its constant exceptionalism totally undermines its ability to carry this advocacy with any force or with any persuasion. What it does is, of course, the United States will always have the power to do good by force if that's the in its own mind, if that's the course that it wishes to pursue. I'm not an American. I don't get involved in American politics. But I will just remind you of something that was very striking to me. First of all, it's a classic American rhetoric. President Clinton at the Denver Democratic Convention used a phrase that to me is quintessential American political rhetoric, but has so much resonance. He said, America will be more successful and have more influence, not by the example of its power, but by the power of its example. And I think in the environment in which I've worked for the last 4 years, it could not be said better that the power of example could go a considerably longer way than the example of power, which is, by definition, unilateral, self-interested, or perceived that way, and grounded in lack of reciprocity and grounded in exceptionalism. So I think it's critical to advocate that, you know, if we believe that successful international justice can only be achieved to be truly just if it's universal, I think the case for the American joining, signing and joining the ranks of the membership in the International Criminal Court would be probably the most significant gesture to move this initiative forward.
I wanted to ask you if you could comment on the prosecutorial style of your successor, Carlo Del Ponte, and would maybe that kind of dependence on national governments bring those criminals to justice, could that be resolved by maybe having some sort of a force or a corp of international prosecutor that he would have or that she would have at her own disposal that she would be able to deploy, you know, and like, you know, that would give some gravity to that institution, I think.
Well, I could not and certainly would not dream of commenting on the performance of either my predecessors, my successors. It's hard enough to do that job when you're in it. I think armchair observers are not particularly helpful, so I won't say anything. The fact that there's been, I think in recent years, more of a push towards domestic prosecutions is probably based on several factors. The first one is, as I mentioned before, the tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, was created by the Security Council, is underwritten by the United Nations. There have been several observations about the cost, the pace of the enterprise. So the Security Council started dictating termination or exit strategies. When you've already investigated and you realize the magnitude of the responsibility that could not possibly be accounted for in an international forum, the natural step is to try to push that back into domestic courts. Second, it coincided with all the talks around the ICC that largely favored domestic prosecutions over international ones. And if you look in contrast with what happened in Rwanda, where the government set out this Gacaca system of national prosecutions and is now, I think, crumbling under the sheer numbers of accusations that have been made for what one might call low-level perpetrators, not the great architects of the genocide, but literally the hundreds of thousands of people that it took to exterminate over 800,000 people in 100 days. This is a real dilemma. And frankly, I haven't followed sufficiently closely whether this kind of pushback of the cases into Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia has been a successful enterprise or a very problematic one. But I think this is one of the issues that we have to ask ourselves. After the leadership has been made accountable, is there a time where the process has kind of exhausted itself, or is it critical to keep in place a kind of lower key but long-term and very far-ranging accountability process? It's not unlike some of the debate that is taking place in this country now about who, if any, should be held accountable, assuming, and I'll say that as a footnote, assuming that prosecutions or criminal accountability is required. In my view, if anything, it is somewhat premature to have a debate as to whether there should be broad amnesties or full-range prosecution. What is severely lacking is public information about what actually happened. We have lived in the Western world, certainly in America, but in Europe, in Canada, under a veil of secrecy unprecedented, certainly in my adult life, about what our governments have been doing on our behalf in the name of national security. We've tolerated an unprecedented veil of secrecy. So until we have a better understanding of not just what was done, but how systemic was it, how many professionals in the health sector, in the legal profession, were co-opted in support of, what was it, a deliberate vast enterprise to pervert the law, or just a few very misguided decisions made when judgments were blurred by the magnitude of the events? We don't know any of that. And I think as informed public opinion, to tell our governments what we expect of them, the first thing we need is some clarity on what happened. And I think the same is true for after conflict. What kind of mechanisms of peace, justice, reconciliation have to be put in place? Above all, it requires clarity and knowledge.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.